So what I want to do today is talk about developmental origins or bases of species differences in brain region size. And that comes really from my effort in the past to study brain evolution in terms of adult brains, comparing adult brains of different species, mostly at the anatomical level. And then at some point realizing that, well, the way you get to different adult brains is by somehow changing the development of those brains. And then it becomes an issue of, well, comparing, how do you compare entire ontogenies of brains? My talk will be a little slower, I think. I only have 19 slides and then 3 sort of kept in reserve. I think there should be plenty of time to go.
I'm giving you your talk, so maybe you have to. Just kidding.
It's also very much sort of work that I just started. We only have published one thing on this with my student, Christine. And most of the other stuff is not published yet, and I'm looking for feedback and input on how one maybe could study it more effectively. So the general problem that I'm interested in is how you create, or how evolution has created, species differences in brain proportions. And just to give you some idea, here are 3 different primate brains, and you can see the neocortex here in red, and you can see that in a chimpanzee is a relatively large fraction of the brain, whereas in a macaque it's proportionally smaller, and it's proportionally smaller yet in a lemur. And in general, if you make a graph of total brain weight and fraction of the total brain weight, that is the telencephalon, you can see that the telencephalon is about 20 to 40% in these small brain animals, that the neocortex is about 20 to 40%, whereas when you get to humans or sperm whales, it is pretty much nearly all of the brain. So this is what I mean by variations in proportions. Here I just threw in the cerebellum, just to show you that the cerebellum stays relatively constant, which in a way, if you think about it, if this is going up, something else must go down. And so I think we had this in one of the talks a couple of weeks ago, about a week ago exactly. Actually, the cerebellum does scale with the neocortex. That's why it seems to be relatively constant, because it goes up with the neocortex. So where a lot of other things like the medulla actually go down, the cerebellum actually stays fairly constant.
So that's counterintuitive. I thought that cerebellum, for example, in three-dimensionally moving animals like birds, was relatively larger than something like a turtle, which has 2 dimensions and not much of that. So
first of all, this is just mammals.
Okay.
And these scaling relationships are a little different for different animal groups. But in general, a lot of this is what's kind of unexpected, that these scaling relationships are so nice. Of course, there's a fair bit of noise, right? And that's why I sort of show you some of the outliers here. But it's surprising how regular these scaling things are, and how the proportions change predictably with overall brain size. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. We had this long discussion during Susanna's talk
about
the loss of this type and about what was the right quantity to use, whether it was volume or weight or number of neurons. So she showed a plot exactly like this, where it was volume, if I remember correctly, which is
right.
But so where does this all fall in the little island?
Exactly.
How do you determine your axis on this curve with the question of fraction of total brain weight, fraction of the brain?
So this is just, here I would just take the volume of the neocortex divided by the total brain weight, which is exactly the same thing I plotted here. So that's very straightforward. But you're right, there's a big issue about that. And if you let me just go on to the next slide, I can show you a little bit about, if you just compare, for example, insectivores, a bunch of different kinds of insectivores and primates, you do the same kind of graph here, the fraction of the brain that's neocortex. You can see that primates, even at the same brain size, they have a larger neocortex. And part of that probably is due to this difference in the scaling law, and they probably have a higher density of cells. And so I was very interested in, and I have to admit, even though I should have known about this, I didn't know about Susanna's work, so this was one very positive experience for me to learn about her work and And I'll come back to this at the very end, because most of what I'm going to tell you about is based on volume, but I recognize the need to go towards number of cells, and I plan to do that. So these kinds of differences, though, where you have at the same brain size you have a serious difference in proportions, that's something you can't easily explain by some kind of scaling law. So how does that arise? How, if you ask yourself, sort of simply put, what kind of change in development would cause primates to have a larger neocortex than an insectivore has? And one thing you might imagine is that, well, maybe already really early in development, when you first sort of lay down the molecular patterns and assign tissue, like, okay, you're going to be telencephalon, you're going to be midbrain, you're going to be this, maybe already at that point they're different. And if that were the case, then when you look at these early embryos, and here's a young embryo, here would be the telencephalon, here would be the midbrain, here's going down into the spinal cord. When you just compare a bunch of them, you see, well, it's hard to tell. Does this primate, does it have a bigger telencephalon in proportion to the rest already at this early stage than these guys? Well, these drawings, by the way, are from a very intriguing sort of five-volume work by this Danish gentleman called Krabbe, who went to Sweden and, based on all these serially sectioned embryos, reconstructed the 3D thing and 3D organization of these embryonic brains, and then had an artist draw them from the side. But there's no volume information there, so actually I can't tell anything. It's really frustrating. So it's really hard to tell from this. But in general, the idea seems to be.
Those are all drawn to scale. There's a scale bar there, right?
Yeah, they're roughly drawn to scale.
And are they, how's the developmental age?
Well, see, this is the other frustrating thing with his work, is he doesn't really tell you. He tells you, well, they're early. And the other ones, he has other pictures in there. There are hundreds of pictures of these brains in them. A lot of them, other ones are late, or middle period. And then he gives you, like, you know, snout to tail, tip of tail length. And you go, well, how am I supposed to compare that between a cattle embryo and a mouse lemur embryo? And it's very, very difficult to do. And I'll try to tell you how we've tackled that in part. And in general, I mean, so just to finish up, in general, the idea, because this is so difficult to do, the general idea seems to be, like, all these early embryos are pretty much all the same. And they kind of look the same. And so then, if they're all the same, then you would say, well, the differences in proportions later, they must arise as a result of something other than sort of allocation at the time of brain regionalization, something maybe to do with how many times a cell divide and so forth.
Do these dotted lines have some meaning, or is that?
Yeah, they have some meaning to him, and I erased them. They were all just pointers to various things, and I believe in making drawings simple rather than complicated. So. But I couldn't get rid of them inside the thing.
Well, probably he meant also separation between hindbrain and mesencephalon and things like that.
Well, they point, like, this is the roof of the fourth ventricle. That's probably what that points to. And that would be the same thing he points to here. This is the medulla, and he's pointing to that. But I wanted people to just focus on the general pattern rather than the details of the names.
He mentioned that he tried to get these at this stage because of that old phylum-type idea that from Bayer had, that for every phylum they look the same in early development.
I think that's the general idea, that there's some sort of phylotypic stage. Now, if you read his work, he doesn't actually say, there's not much theoretical context in which he doesn't really embed it. Even though there's five volumes, it doesn't really actually ever get around to saying how he thinks about it. It's very, very frustrating. But I think that's the general message, is that there's some sort of phylotypic stage there early on that things are going from. So when I decided, okay, I'd like to know, you know, how you make a larger, proportionately larger telencephalon, say, in some species than others, I decided, well, what am I going to do? Breed wild horses and cattle and seals in my lab? That's not really going to be very practical. And so I decided that since I already knew something about birds, I would study birds where birds like these, the bobwhite quail, you can actually buy their eggs. I get them shipped to me from places where Dick Cheney likes to go hunting and that kind of thing. And these guys we can breed in the lab. I will call them parakeets, but you might know them as budgies or budgerigars. And I picked these two species. Of course, you know, there's a lot of different birds out there. Why pick these two? Well, you got to start somewhere, and I decided just to start with a two taxon comparison. If you know anything about evolution, it's really not ideal to start with two taxa. So we're now spreading out to other species as well. But for today, I'll just talk about those two. I picked them in part because even though this guy is three times as heavy as this guy, the brains are actually the same size in these two species. So if you're talking about sort of comparing proportions, it's a lot easier to do when you have brains that are roughly the same size. And in this guy, the telencephalon, or the forebrain, right? Birds don't really have a neocortex, but I'll just talk about the telencephalon, is about 70% of the brain. In this guy, it's about 50% of the brain. So they are rather extremes in terms of variations in brain proportions. So here, I'm giving you a slightly different measure here, which is just telencephalon divided by the quote brainstem. This is like the kind of brainstem that the clinicians like to talk about, including basically everything that's not midbrain roof or telencephalon is I'm going to call brainstem here. And here's just brain volume again. And you can see that the bobwhite quail here, this ratio is relatively small. The parakeet has got a much larger telencephalon relative, now in this case, to the brainstem, even though the two are roughly at the same overall brain weight. Doing the zebrafinch here and some other songbirds, because we're looking at them as well. And I should point out that, you know, even though I don't want to talk about comparative intelligence here, there is some sort of unspoken idea here that the animals with the proportionally larger telencephalon do seem to be smarter in general than the ones with the proportionally small telencephalon. That's part of what I'm interested in the long run.
Do you remember which species is the red dot quite at the top?
Okay.
Yeah. It's Alex, the parent.
No, that's a good question. I don't remember now. There's some noise in these data, you know. I actually wasted a lot of time trying to understand why the chicken has such a outrageously small telencephalon, only to realize that actually most chickens have a perfectly normal telencephalon. It's just this one data point in this one paper. I don't know what he did to his poor chicken, but I think he must have raised it under really poor conditions. So you have to be careful with these data.
Are these adults?
These are adults, yeah. And that's the question, of course, is how do these adult differences arise?
What's the phylogenetic origin of the parakeet? We know it's a domesticated species.
We don't know too much about wild budgerigars. In general, a lot of these birds that I will talk about are domesticated to some extent in the sense that they've been bred for a number of generations, but they haven't been domesticated in the same way that a turkey has been or a chicken, in the sense of some of these animals that have been heavily domesticated for food production have sort of shrunken their brains. But like I said, actually the chicken, it doesn't seem to be the case. Turkey, it does seem to be the case. So I'm going to assume for now that these are fairly normal brain sizes. We're not looking at some total artifact of domestication, but to some extent that's the case. Yeah?
And what was your basis for ascribing differences in intelligence between these?
Well, I've worked a lot with parakeets, and I know the literature on chickens and so forth, intelligence fairly well. Chickens are a lot smarter than we give them credit for. Usually, they have things like what we call audience effects. That the rooster will do one thing if a hen is watching, and a different thing if no hen is watching, and so forth. Parakeets, even the bird intelligence literature, they can do some pretty amazing things that just haven't been reported for others, like motor imitation, certainly the vocal imitation, observational learning by imitation. That's my main, and also in terms of social systems, these things. But like I said, comparative intelligence is a really messy business. We are constantly wondering, what's my dimension when comparison? So here, just to show you, that if you've ever had a parakeet, that most of that head actually is full of brain. It's not some tiny little thing sitting in there. It's a pretty big brain. This is all telencephalon. This is this midbrain tectum. In mammals, we call it the superior colliculus. This is the cerebellum, and this is the medulla here going off into the spinal cord. This is in an adult. This is at 25 days, and this is at 18 days, and they hatch about 18 days. So already from that, you can tell that the proportions of these different things change, of these different brain regions change as they develop. You can see that at hatching, the teleencephalon is not quite as big proportionally as it is going to be later, and the teleencephalon is quite large. The tectum is quite large. Cerebellum is a late developing structure. It's sort of a late bloomer. So these things sort of shift in size as development proceeds, so that they're not growing isometrically. All these different things have different growth rates.
Does that match to something in your environment, for example, in the cerebellum growing? Is that related to them learning to fly or something?
We don't know exactly. You can correlate it. You can try to correlate it with behavior. In general, it sure seems to me that the brainstem, all the vital functions, are pretty much set up by hatching. Everything is in place. And in many species, also, the tectum is done by hatching. The cerebellum, probably later in part because the fine motor control comes later. But we still don't know what the cerebellum does exactly, so it's hard to be sure. But maybe we can come back to that also later, especially when you start comparing the parakeets or the budgies and the quail. If you now look at these guys, so one big difference that you have to keep in mind when you're comparing them is these guys are what we call altricial. That is, they hatch in a fairly immature state, and they get fed by their parents for several weeks after hatching. These guys, they do not get fed by their parents. They hatch at 23 days or so, and about 3 days later, they start feeding for themselves. When you compare, make an isochronic comparison, you can see, look at this big tectum here. Compare that to the relatively small tectum. That's something I actually hadn't known before I started this. I thought I was so fixated on the teleencephalon, as most of us are, that you sort of forget the rest of the brain. And look at the teleencephalon is indeed proportionately quite a bit smaller in the quail than in the parakeet. Okay, so this is what you can see sort of just looking from the outside. But I said, well, I really want to know how these differences arise. So I've got to look at embryos. I've got to look at earlier embryos. And how do I do that? So we collect eggs, we put them in the incubator. Here's a parakeet embryo, 6 days of development. Then we stage them, and I don't want to get into that too much, but there's sort of when you do embryology, there's a traditional way that has been worked out, certainly for the chickens, where you stage them. Mostly people use the limbs, like this is a limb shape characteristic of stage 27, according to Hamburger and Hamilton. And we can do that with our parakeets. We can do the same kind of thing with our quail. We can also plot the stage versus the incubation time. And I don't want to spend too much on that, but basically the stages sort of go along. There's a little bit of noise. And nobody understands exactly where that noise comes from. You look at a bunch of embryos on day 6. Some of them will be a little bit preemie, and some of them will be a little bit later, even if they were incubated at the same age. The parakeets are maybe one or two stages ahead in terms of the morphological limb development at these early stages, but then there's more or less a line. Only reason why this becomes important is that during the talk, I'll sometimes talk about days of development and sometimes about stage, and you just have to go back and forth a little bit. Yes?
I thought that animals reared by their parents in a nest had much less noise because the parents are actually interacting with the eggs. So in ducks and geese, for example, they're actually vocalizing, right. They're actually putting water on the eggs. And if you look at the 20 different goose eggs, they're laid at 3-day intervals, and then they all hatch within 2 hours of each other. That's synchronization by the parent.
What happens is, what you described is a very intriguing phenomenon that actually the little hatchling, close to hatching, the embryos, particularly of quail, that's where it's been studied best, and chickens, they start vocalizing inside the eggs, and they're somehow listening to each other, and they are then hatching all together. at the same time, which is actually, if you think about it, you can sort of see the evolutionary advantage of all hatching together rather than sort of dribbling out. Earlier, they're still terribly asynchronized, and partly the reason why you have this behavioral synchronization through the peeping noises is because of that earlier noise. So it's not like they're synchronized all the way along. It's just that they're synchronized at the last stage. Basically, you can think of it as some of them are just sort of sitting there waiting for their brothers and sisters to get ready before they hatch.
But you can get that in the artificial incubator with like a two-day difference in starting?
No, but most of what I do is before hatching. These are all pre-hatching embryos. So, yeah, no. In fact, that's how they discovered it. When you take a clutch and you separate them so they can't hear each other, they hatch asynchronously. When you put them together, they hatch synchronously. Okay, so then we take these embryos and we do the sort of classical anatomy. We embed them in paraffin, we section them, we stain them, and then we can sort of delineate these various brain regions, and we can measure the volume, basically using some sort of stereological techniques to measure how big is the teleencephalon, how big is the pectum. As I'll mention, there's sort of a stage before which you can't really tell what's going to be what, but the stages I look at here, we can sort of tell what are the major brain regions, and then we can construct growth curves. And when we do that for the teleencephalon, now these are just growth curves, basically, with sort of a smoothing spline put through there. Teleencephalon volume versus age. It's sort of surprising that the teleencephalon at these embryonic stages doesn't really, it's very similar between our two species. I should point out, this stage is actually 1 week post-hatching. The red ones hatch here, black ones hatch here. But I don't really, because one is altricial, one is precocial, I'm sort of saying let's just not worry about when they hatch. Let's just track them all to about 25 days. The medulla, also fairly similar. I mean, there's maybe something interesting going on here, but it's hard to tell statistically. It's very hard to do statistics on these kinds of noisy growth curves. But the most interesting thing is that something is going on in the tectum. Basically, at every age we examine, the parakeet has a smaller tectum than the quail does when you match them for age. Okay, and these are log scales, so these are fairly significant size differences.
You match them by stage?
So you can do this, that's what I say, I'll go back and forth. When you do a growth curve by stage, it kind of loses all meaning in a way. If you're doing a growth curve, you're interested in, you know, over this period of time, how much does it grow? And in the long term, I do want to have cell counts that go with this, so I can figure out what's the doubling time and so forth between day 5 and day 10, and you'll see why I want to do that in a few minutes. So then it makes sense to have a time base rather than a stage base, which is arbitrary, right? But since for each one of these, I could draw it for you for stages, and you get the same result. Turns out people, when they assigned their stages, they actually did it on like a log scale, basically. So this is probably more interesting rather than absolute volumes. When you look at this percent of the brain that's teleencephalon, or as I call it, teleencephalon volume fraction, you can see the parakeet. In the beginning, the teleencephalon is not that much bigger proportionally compared to a quail, but the difference gradually gets bigger. If you do this other thing that I mentioned where you compute the ratio, pretty similar throughout the early stages of development, and at some point the parakeet just sort of takes off, the teleencephalon takes off. The tectum gives you a very different pattern, just like I showed you with the absolute volumes. It is a much smaller structure in the parakeets. All along development, no matter whether you look at it as a percent or as a ratio. And so that fact that even when I look really early, you know, this is only 4 days after I start incubation, it's already much smaller, and the difference stays roughly the same, suggests to me that maybe it really is different from the beginning, whatever that exactly means. You know, by that I would mean it's the tectum of this guy is smaller from the time that the molecular patterning machinery allocates this tissue to become tectum.
Maximum 10 days.
Yeah, you know, this Mexican hat thing, I don't know exactly. I knew someone was going to ask me that, and I still don't, I can give you some sort of answers, but I don't really know exactly even why that, I've gone back to look at the absolute growth curves to figure out where is this coming from. I think it has to do mostly with the fact that the medulla has a very strange growth curve where at first it gets set up and it grows for a while, and then I think axons start coming in from other brain regions and then it grows again. So it grows, becomes stable for a little bit, and then it grows again, and I think that's what shape comes.
Could you go back one where you showed us the
calcium comes? Mm-hmm. Okay, see that? The medulla, it's like this, and it sort of gets stable and then it grows again. I think that it's something in there.
Well, the technique is going to be.
And the skull is just growing to accommodate this, and it has an upper size limit that it achieves at some point.
Yeah, the skull, it's weird. You'd think that the skull would sort of hem it in, but that skull just does accommodates the brain, whatever, to just do things. At these late stages, I have sort of a separate idea about really early stages of development where maybe the forces, balance of forces would be different so that the skull or the epidermis could actually constrain things. But in this case, I think the skull is permissive, so to speak. Yeah?
Do these species show a difference in eye size or in retinal ganglion cell?
They do. The parakeets have much smaller eyes, which makes sense in terms of the optic tectum is the major recipient of the retina, and they have smaller. So the red guys also have smaller eyes, smaller tectum and smaller eyes. But it can't be the case that the retina is causing this because they're not connected until about here or so. Yeah, you'd like to know if there's some sort of trophic interaction. Right, so our hypothesis at this point is that if I could look even earlier, I would find a similar difference in the tectum size. But I can't with my morphological techniques. I can't look earlier, so now we're starting to use some marker genes. And here's a candidate gene called MICE2 that seems to be selectively expressed in the tectum. I have to admit, this is a fairly late tectum, okay? We have to look much earlier than this, but literally these are sort of, we're just trying various antibodies. We're also trying in situs just to see what will work because, you know, it's hard in comparative work. It's not a mouse, it's not a chicken. These are strange species, and I'm not equipped to just pull out any gene that I want to. I don't have the money for that at this point. We're also trying PAX7, which is probably closer to the patterning mechanism of the tectum, which is actually fairly well understood. So PAX7 is one of the earliest markers of that. And at this point, we get it to work in the parakeet tectum. Unfortunately, we also get a little bit of this part of the diencephalon, but we're working on that. So I don't have much more to say on that, but this is where we're going with that. And if we are successful, I think it'll be neat because it'll be, I don't know of any other example from the vertebrates at least where a difference in brain proportion could be traced back to actual patterning mechanism. But I still had this issue of like, what's happening with the telencephalon? Why do adult parakeets end up with such a large telencephalon? Okay, so here's the tectum. If you look at a cross section, you can even see, I mean, it's kind of obvious actually, the quail. Look at how big that tectum is. Look at how small this guy is. Okay, it's a very big difference. But when you look at the telencephalon, they actually don't look all that different when you do the volumes or in individual sections. But we did notice something interesting. If you look more closely, like zooming in on this region here, or here on this region, now I have to tell you a little bit about how brains develop. Usually, all the proliferating cells sit in what we call a ventricular zone. Okay, here all the cells are dividing and multiplying, and when they leave the cell cycle, they migrate out and they form this mantle zone. So really early in development, there really is just a ventricular zone. There's just this epithelium, cells dividing, that causes this ballooning and all of that. At some point, the cells leave the cell cycle and they start building brain tissue, basically, the mantle zone. Now, these are actually the same physical age, and when you do that kind of comparison, you see that at the same age, the parakeet has a much narrower mantle zone than the parakeet does, even though the ventricular zone is roughly the same thickness. And we express this in terms of what I like to call a proliferative zone fraction. So A fraction of one means there's no mantle zone yet at all. A fraction of zero means there's no more ventricular zone, because eventually this does get exhausted and then the brain is done developing. When you do that kind of plot, ventricular zone fraction versus age, you can see that the medulla, actually the two are pretty much lined up. But when you look in the teleencephalon, you can see that the parakeet is lagging behind the quail. In other words, it seems that the cells in the parakeet, ventricular zone, they keep going a little bit, a few extra cell divisions before they leave the cell cycle. If you think about that, right, that's a good way maybe to make a bigger teleencephalon, is by just having the precursors of the teleencephalon delay cell cycle exit a little bit and divide a little bit more. And that's our current hypothesis. And I think there was someone here, Richard Nowakowski was here maybe week one, where he showed that there are really nice techniques for actually measuring cell cycle exit probabilities. And he showed you, I think, beautiful data for the neocortex of a mouse, showing you how that function works. And we're trying that. It's just that actually, his data, that took several grad students many, many years to figure out. And we're trying to do it in multiple species, in multiple brain regions. And so we have to do some, we have to take some shortcuts, and we're working on that.
So when you talk about some fraction in between the ventricular zone and the mantle zone?
Right.
Because one of the things that Richard showed was that he was talking about this symmetric deletion versus asymmetric deletion, and the proliferative cells that produce two proliferative cells versus the one that divide asymmetrically, and then one goes on the layers. And one of the things he showed was that the number of cells, and therefore the depth of the ventricular zone, first increased. So at the beginning, you had a lot of symmetric deletions that proliferate cells into more proliferative cells. And that would increase the bank of cells at the beginning. And only then it thins, and then eventually everything, of course, goes into the mantle.
And that's exactly what I think is going on here, except one of the things that's interesting, when you take this ventricular zone, it's actually what we call a pseudo-stratified epithelium. It's just one layer thick, but they're all squished together. And when you grow that population more, it doesn't grow much in thickness. Instead, it just grows in surface area and just becomes a bigger balloon. But I think that's, yeah, essentially. And so our hypothesis right now is that the enlargement of the parakeet's teleencephalon is in part due to a delay in neurogenesis within the teleencephalon that's somewhat selective to the teleencephalon. So it's not like the whole brain is delayed. That wouldn't give you any change in proportions.
But that would also lead to a different proportion of layers, right?
Well, except that there are no layers. The whole thing, that's why I said it's not really a neocortex, but yeah, if this was going into a cortex, you would expect certain changes in the thickness of the layers. Because, yeah, people have done that in mutants of mice. Okay. So now we already have sort of at least a hypothesis of delayed neurogenesis, and we have this idea that maybe there's a change in allocation at the time of patterning. It's already two mechanisms, and we thought, part of what appealed to me about this from the beginning is that there's only so many things you can change, right? You could change the allocation, you could change maybe many times you have the cell cycle, maybe you can change cell death. I'm not going to talk about that today. And you could maybe change the rate at which the cells are cycling. So I was thinking, okay, let's look at rate at which the cells are dividing. That should be relatively constant. Let's just hope, you know, because it'd be nice to have a few things constant. And that turned out not to be the case. Evolution just changes too many things sometimes. So we began measuring cell cycle rates, and you basically use two techniques to do that. And I don't want to, you know, spend too much time on techniques, but particularly for those of you who already heard Nowakowski, it's probably not that strange. There's a substance called BRDU that is a thymidine analog that when you give it to an animal, it will get incorporated in all of the cells that are currently making DNA. So it gets incorporated into all the cells that are in S phase of their cell cycle. If you look sort of in one of these ventricular zones, and you look 30 minutes after giving that BRDU, this is roughly what it would look like. You can see the brown cells here, the ones that are labeled with BRDU. If you take a different embryo and you say, well, instead of killing it 30 minutes later, I want to wait 3 hours, the BRDU hangs around. So just more and more cells start getting labeled with BRDU as they come into S phase. And then some cells will have left S phase, but they keep that BRDU in them. So as you wait 3 hours, or in another case, if you wait 6 hours, sooner or later, you will label all dividing cells with BRDU. If you have a bunch of different embryos and you sacrifice some of them at 30 minutes, some of them at 3 hours, some of them at 6 hours, 9 hours, 12 hours, you can actually build a graph that shows you what fraction of all my cells in this zone are labeled with BRDU, are brown versus blue. And that would be my labeling index. This is basically the fraction of all the cells in this area that are brown. You can see eventually you get to near one, meaning all the cells essentially are labeled. And the slope here, and what I show you here is a quail at stage 24 or stage 28. The slope of this line is inversely proportional to the cell cycle rate. Because basically, intuitively, the way to think about it is like, well, how long will it take for all the cells to get labeled? Well, if the cells are dividing quickly and moving out of S phase and into S phase very quickly, it won't take very long. But if they're all cycling very slowly, it'll take a long time. So that's why these slopes tell you basically about the cell cycle time, TC. And here at stage 28, we got a cell cycle time estimate of about 20 hours. You can also estimate S phase duration, but I just want to focus on this. It's about 20 hours. Stage 24 is about 11 hours. And this
you
is.
You plug it up there as you continuously, right?
Pardon me?
You apply it there as you continuously.
Yeah, in an egg, it's actually very difficult to not apply it continuously because it just sits there. You drop it in, it just sits there. In a mouse, you inject it, the mouse metabolism will actually break it down very quickly, and it's gone after 30 minutes. Here, it just sits there.
So are some of the mitoses occurring away from the ventricular surface?
They all would be occurring down here. You can actually see.
So they very quickly migrate up.
Well, these are S phase. So if you want to see labeled mitoses, you have to wait about 3 hours, and then you start seeing some labeled mitoses. I'll show you some labeled mitoses in a minute.
So the red dots off the line are not dilution of label, but something else, right?
Sorry, say again?
The red, over to the right, the next three dots.
These are what I call saturation labeling. Basically, once you're close to 98% label, it would be silly to fit a line to this. You have to fit the line to before you reach saturation labeling. So this was not terribly surprising. A lot of people have described, including Nowakowski, that basically as you go, you know, with every cycle, things slow down a little bit. And so really what we wanted to do is to do this at all these different age points in both species. But look at how many embryos there are, how much data you have to gather. This became sort of something where I felt like, given my one student, I wasn't going to have her spend that many months doing that. So we thought, well, let's see if we can be clever about this. And we thought that maybe we can at least get an estimate of relative cell cycle rates. And what we did is we decided to use a marker for mitotic cells. This is a phosphorylated histone 3. And what it does is it labels cells in mitoses. It's a very widely used marker for mitotic cells. And we thought, let's combine that with a label for all proliferating cells called PCNA, proliferating cell nuclear antigen. And that's why all these cells are blue here, but you can see some of them are brown. As you can see from this, the mitoses tend to be on the ventricular side for most early brains. That's where most of the mitoses tend to be. And this is just a close-up. You can see the mitoses here. And this is the ventricular zone. Outside the ventricular zone, you do have the marker PCNA. It's not perfect. It does sort of label weakly some of the cells that have left the cell cycle. And there are some mitoses out here that I'll come back to. There's some mitoses outside of the ventricular zone that are very interesting. I call them non-VZ rather than subventricular zone, but that's what most people would prefer. So if you think about this, if you had some knowledge about how long M phase was, right? and most people think M phase is about 1 hour long, then you should be able to calculate that if, say, if 10% of my cells are in M phase, and M phase is 1 hour long, then my total cell cycle time must be around 10 hours. Right? And if I look at different ages and assume that my mitotic duration stays constant, I should be, if my ratio goes down, then the cells must be slowing down. And so based on that assumption, we looked at these ratios in the teoencephalon. I'm just focusing on the teoencephalon. We also looked at the tectum, and those are my three backup slides. And we looked at these various stages, and the gray here is the quail, and you can see that the ratio goes down with age. And in the parakeets, you get this pattern that really surprised us. The parakeets seem to keep a high ratio for much longer and then start dropping off. So I'm still struggling with the words how to say this. It's like the parakeets delay the decline in cell cycle rates that would normally occur. I mean, in effect, what that amounts to is that the new cells are cycling faster. The parakeets in the teoencephalon, the cells are cycling faster sort of over that period on average. Okay?
But if you use this method to determine cell cycle duration for the time points that you actually know.
Yes. Then you should be able to give yourself some calibration, right? Of what
you have actually took on two points, right?
Right.
So from one you could infer the duration of.
Exactly. So we did that. And what we come up with is that, so you understand what he was saying? It's like we did quail for stage 24, and we did quail for 28. That's what we just showed you. And now we have the ratios, and so we can infer that M phase in our species must be about 1 hour long. That's what comes out. And if that's the case, and we assume that it stays similar in over time, then it goes roughly from 10 hours here to about 45 hours here is the cell cycle duration. And if we assume that the parakeet is similar to the quail, it goes from about 10 hours to about 22 to 25 hours here in terms of how quickly the cells are cycling. Okay, I'm getting to the end here. I'll mention one other really interesting thing about this, because this puzzled us. We didn't expect this. I thought there would be mostly the cell cycle exit delay, right? That they're delaying neurogenesis. That would be enough. Why do you need this? But then I started reading about this, and it turns out there's actually it might be the case that cell cycle length is actually linked to cell cycle exit. So there's this idea out there that if cells are cycling very quickly, there are certain proteins that the cells are experiencing during their G1 phase. If they experience them for long enough, the cell will leave the cell cycle. But if they don't experience them for very long, they stay in the cell cycle. So when the cell starts slowing down, there might be sort of a critical point where, hey, I'm slow enough now, I need to leave the cell cycle. So we actually think that this delay in the decline of the cell cycle rate might actually be linked to a delay of neurogenesis, and we're very excited about that possibility, although I don't know at this point how I can test that directly. And one more thing on this slide here, a sort of exciting thing that fell out of this is when you look at these non-VC cells that are dividing, that is, I mentioned earlier that most of the cells that are dividing are in this ventricular zone, but there's some cells dividing just outside of it. And normally, in a quail, that's not a very large fraction, and it sort of declines with age. In a parakeet, that is a huge and growing fraction. So there are lots of cells, especially by the time you get close to hatching, the parakeets have lots of cells outside of the ventricular zone that are dividing. And this is what in mammals is known as the subventricular zone, and has often been speculated that in primates too, that this subventricular zone expansion might be related to growing a larger brain.
Are these cells similar to the ones that have been found in songbirds that are renewed every year? Are they?
They could be. It could be. We don't know. It could be. We're doing all this now in songbirds and zebra finches and trying to figure out. These are way too many cells to be entirely just those.
Is there any what again, the difference between the cells that divide at the bottom of the particular zone and the ones that divide in the southern particular zone?
We don't know. Also, I think Alex mentioned that there's some idea that maybe the ones in the ventricular zone tend to be more, have more symmetrical cell divisions in the sense of, you know, their daughters are both going to be alike and like the mother, whereas these cells might be more asymmetrical. But I'm very reluctant to go out on a limb too far. We don't even know exactly, we can't even do these rate measurements. We don't even know if these cells are dividing more quickly or more slowly. But what I'm intrigued by is that maybe these cells in the parakeet, maybe this increase in that's part of the problem. I have this idea that these non-VZ cells, what we call the subventricular zone cells that are dividing outside the ventricular zone, I think they might actually be generated by really high rates of cell division within this ventricular zone when there's already a mantle zone. So you can't stretch your balloon anymore, you can't blow it up anymore, and these cells are being cranked out, and there's no place to put them. So they have to leave the ventricular zone in order to, you know, to exist. And I think that's why these guys are building up. It's an idea of sort of linking the mechanics of development. More and more as we learn about it, development is not just about gene expression, it's also about the physics of how you fit cells together and how that in turn can affect gene expression. I'm very interested in that, but I don't really know how to get at it at this point. All right, so there's a puzzle here though that, remember I showed you this growth curve that the teoencephalon doesn't really grow much faster in a parakeet than in a quail, but I just told you that the cells are cycling faster and the cells are cycling for a longer period of time in the sense that they're delaying neurogenesis or leaving the cell cycle. So they really, the parakeets ought to grow faster.
And they eventually become bigger.
Eventually they become bigger. In the adult they're bigger, but by stage 25 there isn't much difference yet. And I think Susanna has the answer.
Is the volume actually bigger, George? Because the volume of what you showed is fractions before, but you can't tell by looking at the...
Yeah, this is the actual volume.
Yeah, that's the... But I mean, if you look at the adult, is the actual volume of the teoencephalon bigger?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think the resolution is there if you look... So here's a quail, and these are sections through at 23 days. So quail... And through a parakeet, and this is anterior and posterior within that teoencephalon. And see this little shade? It's easier to see here. You see this denser area? This is that subventricular zone that I was talking about these cells that are, there are lots of cells in here going through mitosis, and actually here they're labeled with BRDU just to convince you there are lots of cells out here undergoing cell division. So very dense, and this cell dense region is much smaller in a quail. So what I'm saying in part is that even though the overall volume might not be that much bigger, there's a really dense zone of cells. And of course, you know, if they're denser, then they don't contribute to overall volume all that much. Plus, they're still dividing. So that would explain why after hatching, the parakeets can keep going. And then one more thing to note that we in the lab always sort of noted, but didn't know what to do with exactly because we were lazy. Look at how much less dense these guys are in the quail than in the parakeet. Even these are cells that are post-proliferative or post-mitotic. And I just didn't have the heart to tell my student to count even more cells. But I think we're going to collaborate with Susanna and just say, hey, we're going to send you some grains, put them in your blender, and let's find out what fraction of these, whether it may be. So I think this puzzle is resolved by the fact that parakeets, that teoencephalon by this age, is not much bigger, but it's full of, it's got more cells in it, and these cells have the potential to give rise to even more cells.
And then later on it expands?
And then later on it expands.
And what triggers?
I think these cells, if you think about it, so this gets us to function a little bit. And some of this is speculation, okay? I mean, a lot of this is speculation. These cells, I think, they're not fully mature. One of the things that happens in all brain regions as they mature is the cells start building up more cytoplasm around their nucleus, and they grow their dendritic tree, and they grow their axons, and that's part of what spaces them out. I think that's fair to say, right? And these guys are still fairly densely packed. And I think they're just telencephalon. It's just not fully developed. And if you think about it, these birds, like I said, they're highly altricial. They're still getting fed by their parents. They don't really need the telencephalon for quite a while. And I think that's... So you're not just delaying neurogenesis onset. You're not just sort of maintaining a higher cell cycle rate. You're also delaying sort of maturation of the whole system in terms of expanding the individual cells.
So you expect the volume of this, average volume of the cell to increase?
Absolutely, yeah. And so this is just summarized here. I think I've just said all of that they have, parakeets have an unusually small optic tectum. And we can talk more about that because it is kind of an interesting, puzzling thing. And the way to think about it, though, is if a parakeet was trying to make a proportionately large telencephalon, you could do all of these things that I just mentioned, but you could also reduce the size of something else. If what matters really is proportional size, then maybe reducing something else is not such a bad idea, and I actually think that's part of what's going on. And then they delay telencephalic neurogenesis and maintain this high cell cycle rates. And like I said, these might be causally linked to one another, and that's very exciting to us.
So, George, if someone gave you blind, an adult telencephalon from a quail and a turkey, could you tell them apart?
Yeah, instant. So that's actually a problem in a lot of these experiments. I can't do anything blind.
Is that because when these cells spread out, they look fundamentally different? So if you have more...
No. I don't think that's it. I just can tell.
But when you put your key, where you keep it?
It's an interesting question. I actually don't know exactly what I'd be keying, but I can tell immediately. It's just mostly it's the distinctiveness of the layers and the size of the individual. There are some layers in here, not the kinds of layers that you would find in the cortex. And maybe there are some differences in the cells. I just don't know. I mean, there's so much we do with our visual system that I just have spent so much time looking at these, I can tell.
I guess I'm getting, if you go back one slide, that then it's not just that a telencephalic cell is a telencephalic cell, because there must be, if you can tell them apart, they're not just expanding those cells, they're wiring them differently or something.
Could be. I just don't know. I mean, I would love someone to have, you know, the whole circuit diagram for all these cells mapped out. We know so darn well.
If you get to the adult, the cell density isn't that different, is it?
I have no data. I don't think so. And that's part of why I never told my student. I always told my student, oh, don't worry about it. It's not going to be different. You know, cell density is pretty much the same. But especially after Amy Susanna's talk, I'm not going to trust my impression anymore. I think we should actually look. And maybe compare even small parrots versus large parrots and that kind of thing.
Let me just ask a question about circuitry. You said these neural tissues don't mature yet. So is the circuitry mature?
I don't know. I'm sorry. You know, I told you this. I got my first grant to work on this about 2 weeks ago. So I'm excited, but I still don't know lots of things.
Is there any relationship to when they exit mitosis and their destinations?
Yes. Usually, so there's an interesting story in the cortex that the cells that are last to leave their birthplace, so to speak, tend to migrate through cells that were already there and to get to the outside. I'm just filling everyone else in.
Oh, sorry.
So in birds in general, the pattern seems to be exactly the opposite. The last ones build up sort of deep to the other ones. They don't go past the older ones. In most brain regions, there's one or two intriguing little exceptions, but in general, it's what we call an outside-in pattern, where it actually looks like the cells are migrating long distances, but they're not. They're sort of getting spit out of this ventricular zone, and they just sit there, and then the next layers get spit out right next to them, and so they just kept getting pushed out further and further.
And this small tectum, it could be that there's the same number of cells, or not?
I think the tectum, there's no way it's the same number of cells, but I actually don't know. Let me just tell you the one last thing. So what? I routinely get asked those questions, and I try to ask myself them before someone else does. And actually, I'm not all that interested in understanding in all these species, you know, the little different intricacies of how, you know, how you actually make differences in brain region size. What really drives me is that when I was writing this book on brain evolution, I started thinking that it does seem to be the case that in evolution, whenever you make a brain region, say, of A and B, if you look here at a different species, you make A much larger relative to B. It seems that A starts to have new connections to targets that it didn't innervate before. In some sense, it actually maybe displaces some of the connections of the now smaller region. You can call that invasion, or, you know, I call it large equals well connected, or whatever, something like that. And so I thought, well, how would you test that? And I thought, it's hard because you don't have a lot of good sort of connectional data, and you could build correlations forever. So what I thought I would like to do is just sort of go into an embryo and dial up a brain region, make it intentionally larger, and then see if it starts having connections that it wouldn't have normally. Now the problem is, of course, when you do that, and we heard, when I first got here about a week ago, we heard that you can make brain regions larger by, say, suppressing cell death or delaying neurogenesis. Usually when people do that, they do that throughout the whole brain. And usually when they do that, the brain looks cancerous and the animals just die and it's not very informative. And so what I thought I would do is try to sort of reverse engineer it. First learn a little bit about how evolution makes brain regions larger or smaller, and then go in a more sort of intelligent way, maybe I shouldn't put it that way, but informed way, manipulate brain region size, and then look for connectional changes. Because I guess part of my assumption here is, or working hypothesis, is that evolution probably designed brains in such a way that relatively small changes in one region would come with changes in connectivity, sort of pre-configured. And I subscribe to this idea that maybe some evolvability has evolved over time. I think that's very interesting. Yeah.
So I think in your first idea might be actually addressable. So earlier was Dennis O'Leary talked here about some experiments in which he changed the proportions of the somatosensory cortex and the visual cortex. So in two different mutations, he had either one of them much larger than the other. There was a similar question there, whether the connectivity changes, and by and large the answer was not known yet. But it's actually quite possible that we could address that question.
Yeah.
George, would another possibility be that the telencephalon is a big, diverse structure that controls lots of things? Maybe if you chose a piece of it where that controlled functions that were different in a different bird species, you could get more quickly at what was different about those areas. So focalizations, for example, is an obvious one, and those nuclei are well known. If you could understand how those were changing as correlated with the functional outcome, you might then be able to see how that's related.
Yeah. You have to be careful, I guess. You know, then you quickly get into sort of the realm of sort of constructing your hypothesis in such a way that you can't fail. Like if I say I want to find out the genes that induce this particular functional brain area in a parakeet, and I try to express them in a quail, and I get connectional changes, I would like to do that. I think it would be interesting to do, but.
How well known are the domains of telencephalic nuclei?
Not known at all. So that's part of why I'm starting with these big areas where I actually know something about the molecular basis. So like with the tectum, I can actually, we know sort of how the boundaries, you know, rostral, dorsal, ventral boundaries, how they get formed. And I have some hope of understanding someday how that works. Plus, I think there's just, I guess I have a sort of an intuition that it's fun to think about all these small areas as if they all get sort of specified independently. But I just think that there may be something that is actually much more global than what evolution dialed up or down is maybe a more global parameter, and a lot of other things fall out. But I don't really know.
So you think there is a database through which, I mean, there is basically a control of relative brain area size?
Well, you know, it's just, people call me terribly naive for that, and I've been told that several times in person, and sometimes from grant reviewers, and it doesn't feel particularly good, but I think that I have to be somewhat naive to even try this. I don't mind. But for in terms of global control, so if you think about parakeet, so I do know something about parakeet vocal control, a lot more than I know about this stuff. And it's true that there are these highly specialized circuits, and that what distinguishes all vocal learning bird species from others is that they have direct connections from their telencephalon to the medulla, to those motor neurons that are actually involved in vocalization. Anytime you've evolved it, that's what happens. It's also true that parrots don't just have direct connections from the telencephalon to those vocal motor neurons, they also have direct connections to, or at least we think so, to motor neurons for the feet. Have you ever seen what parrots can do with their feet? They're not just dexterous with their syrinx, they're also very dexterous with their legs. And in general, I think there are these things that sort of go together. Like, we are not just dexterous with our voice box, we're also dexterous with our hands, with lots of other things. And so I think there are some general patterns here that may hang together in some more global way than just sort of each individual brain area by itself. But it'd be fun to, you know, disprove. At least I think I should be able to disprove myself at some point.
Well, I think it's important to ask the question more of what, which is getting back to what Russell was saying, in the sense that if you've got something like the, when we learned about the zebrafish optic tectum, it just seems to be making a bigger optic tectum to do the same thing because it's got more ganglion cells. And it's an open question whether, in fact, more visual capabilities will simply come out of having an effect of that sort because it's bigger. And you have to distinguish between that and something getting bigger because actually there's more different areas in it. So if you take the whole telencephalon, that gets bigger. Now, is that getting bigger like the tectum's getting bigger just because some peripheral organ or something downstream has got bigger, or is it because actually there's more stuff going on in there?
Well, it could be both. You see, I it could be both. I mean, I agree with you.
Well, I think it's important to try and distinguish.
Well, yes. I think it is. So going back to, I think John Koss did that on Tuesday. He talked about how, in general, when you have a larger cortex, you have more areas within it. If I had to be internally consistent, which is very hard to be, but I would say that if you could dial up a larger cortex, I wouldn't be surprised to see it sort of break up into more distinct areas. And I don't know whether they'd all be functionally the same, or whether evolution would need a long time to actually make them functionally distinct from one another, or whatever. So it could be that this global size parameter could be linked to functional differentiation in some way that is not, you know, that actually brings those two together. I just don't know about the tectum. I have spent a bit of time thinking about the smaller tectum. What could parakeets? What could be the functional significance of that? And one of the things that comes to mind right away is that, first of all, they have smaller eyes, and also one of the big things. And you know more about this than I do, but I think tectum size, it relates to sort of visual acuity. That basically how finely can you resolve particular specks of light or dark. And of course the quail, when they come out, within 3 days they got to start pecking for food, which is basically a visual acuity eye-beak coordination problem, which the tectum is definitely involved in. The parakeets don't really need to do that. It's not clear that they ever need to do that. Of course, they have good vision, but it's probably they use their vision for mostly other things like pattern. You know, they use the visual patterns on their faces and individual recognition, that kind of thing. And that's maybe not as much a tectum problem. So I would like to do things like, what if I could make a smaller tectum and then, or a larger tectum, and see whether that affects things like visual acuity. But the problem there, of course, is I got to figure out the relationship between the eye and the tectum. So first. But I think there might be a relationship there, because if the eye comes in, the tectum is too small, the eye tends to have more cell death. So who knows? This is a really early days. But I'm definitely interested in the functional questions. I just can't see my way into them.
And also the quail has more binocular overlap, which could drive a larger tectum relatively anyway.
Yeah.
And for pecking, that's really necessary. It's not combined in the tectum, but something has to put those two the overlapping visual fields back together, which the parapet doesn't.
I don't know. I actually just don't know about the maybe you know. But
how does the parapet feed
itself? Usually they will eat nuts and fruits and flowers. If you've ever seen these birds attack a flowering tree, it's almost like it starts raining because they just chew up the entire tree. And so a lot of it doesn't require binocular vision. They just need to be able to identify edible parts, and then they have this fancy beak with manipulation, I mean, wonderful tongue for manipulating things.
We know the quail uses binocular vision.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I actually haven't thought much about binocular versus monocular, but I wouldn't be. A lot of birds, it looks like their eyes are lateral and they wouldn't have, but when people have done the actual measurements, there usually is good binocular overlap right underneath the beak where you'd expect it. That much I know. But
there's also all kinds of other monocular cues to that.
Right. A lot of birds will use one eye for one thing and the other eye for the other thing, which is a very strange thing. I've never understood that. But birds don't have, they don't have a corpus callosum, so the two hemispheres are not very tightly connected.
That's typically because, like, birds of prey have two foveates, one, an axial foveate that's much better. So when they're hunting, they'll actually fly and put their head this way and that way because they're actually using this axial foveate. They have another one at the temporal pole, which is used for fixating this one. So they have two specializations in their retinas.
But these are the brainstem nucleus for the binocular processing. It's the parabogenital nucleus. It goes by another name in non-mammals, in which each tectum projects to this brainstem structure, and then it projects to both tecta to provide the anatomical link to mediate the binocular cells that are present there.
There's something like that. I just have not. It's not in my brain anymore.
Well, we hope you still get it.
Thank you.